you've got to be doing it for something bigger than yourself, because you just don't know in life when you have that accident like I had. You know, whether it's business, you're chugging along, everything's going great, and you get broadsided. And if you're just in it for the results, you have no perspective, and you're not going to be able to recover from those catastrophes.
Welcome back to the Impact Entrepreneur Show. My name is Mike Flynn, and I am honored to be your host. Our mission here on the Impact Entrepreneur Show is not just to inspire you, but also to help you tap into and begin to believe in your God-given potential and purpose. That's right, baby. We want you to not only be inspired, but experience breakthrough. And we do that on this podcast by interviewing incredible people who are using their experiences, their skill set, their platforms to have a game-changing impact in the lives of others. And here's the thing. None of these folks are simply sitting back, living a life of leisure. They have things to do, places to go, and lives to impact. Speaking of that, today's guest, like Isaac Newton, has certainly stood on the shoulders of giants. His phenomenal parents, his longtime coach, Alan Arata, Dan O'Brien, the 1996 Olympic decathlon gold medalist, and too many others to name. With the teachings of these mentors as his rock-solid foundation, Eli Bremmer became an Olympian, an Air Force Academy graduate, and a serial entrepreneur specializing in high-impact business activities. These mentors helped Eli become who he was, understand what he was capable of becoming, and what his potential could be. They were more than just leaders. They were partners who invested their time and shined a light on his potential, even when Eli couldn't see it himself. And as you will learn, that made a huge difference. Now, Eli is a modern Olympic pentathlete. And if you're not familiar, the pentathlon is a unique Olympic sport tracing back to the original games. The Greeks valued a well-rounded person, so they created the traditional pentathlon as the culminating event of an early Olympic game. Comprising of a number of fighting skills, the traditional pentathlon included a short foot race, the javelin throw, the discus throw, the long jump, and wrestling. It was the ultimate test of the all-around athlete. Now, when the Olympics were revived in 1912, they kept the idea but chose different events for the modern pentathlon. Fencing, freestyle swimming, equestrian show jumping, and a combined event of shooting and running. Now, through the early 2000s, Eli was an up-and-coming modern pentathlete, winning in the 2007 Pan Am Games and earning a slot for the 2008 Olympics. And before the 2008 Games, Eli was ranked in the top 10 in the entire world. And through training for this taxing event, Eli learned a few lessons that we will all benefit from. One, the harder he trained didn't necessarily equate to getting better, but the more he learned how to recover and to balance everything out, the more he advanced. And as a result, Eli got better at balancing more things in every area of his life and ultimately was able to get more things done, a skill that certainly benefits him today in the entrepreneurial world. Eli also learned to care more about the process than the results. And as soon as Eli made this psychological transition to committing to the process over anything else, his scores got better. He was more consistent and he made fewer errors. The last lesson took a little longer to learn, but it's a goodie. He said, quit trying to win and start trying to be good, because good athletes win more often, because good entrepreneurs win more often, because good husbands, good wives, good parents win more often. Focusing on the outliers too much can put you in a dangerous state of mind, and that is true in competition as much as it is in business or personal life. Unfortunately, Eli experienced a disappointing Olympics in 2008 after a catastrophic horseback riding accident hospitalized him just over a week before competition. The weeks after the accident were devastating, but those lessons Eli learned through training helped carry him through to one of the best performances in his athletic career. Just 2 months after his accident, he won a bronze medal at the World Cup final, the top individual medal won by a U.S. athlete since 1979. There is so much value in this episode. I am incredibly grateful to Eli, and a big shout out and a huge thank you to Ryan Guerra for connecting us. Now bust out your pens and paper, take some notes, and brace for impact. Eli Bremer, let me ask you a question, my man. First of all, welcome to the Impact Entrepreneur Show, and thanks to the incredible Ryan Guerra for connecting us. He's a legend. I always kick things off with my guest origin story, and I use a quote to stimulate the thinking. So this is an Isaac Newton quote, and I think that this will be one that will really truly kick things off in a good way for us, because you have stood on the shoulder of giants. And so the question is, or the quote is, if I have seen further than others, it's by standing upon the shoulders of giants. So who are some of the giants in your life, and what have they helped you see?
Wow, that's a very long list. And before I get started, thanks for having me on today. It's great to be on your show and talk about some really important issues to many people. I think it starts probably with my parents, and in particular, my dad. I mean, he's a great role model. He's just was amazing in terms of teaching things like integrity and hard work and discipline and stuff like that. So he's still one of my very best friends to this day, and we have an outstanding relationship. So I think I was blessed with having great parents. But then I also had some great mentors as I started going through life. I met a gentleman by the name of Alan Arata when I was in high school, and he sort of became a mentor to me on sports. And he coached me all the way through the Olympics, and we just worked so incredibly well together. So people like that. Dan O'Brien, the 96 gold medalist in the decathlon, he came on board as a mentor to me as well, and helped me learn a tremendous amount about sports methodology, about high performance. So I could just go on and on. There's so many of them.
What did they help you see about yourself?
Well, they really helped me understand who I was, who I am, and what my potential would be. And we're much more partners than just straight up leaders or anything like that. So people that took time to invest in me personally, that saw something in me that sometimes I saw, sometimes I didn't. Mm-hmm. And that makes a big difference.
You said that what was the name of your high school coach again?
Alan Arata.
Alan Arata. You said that you guys worked well together. And I think that is something that I don't want to necessarily overlook, because in any partnership, obviously, there's a desire for everyone, all parties involved, to work well together. So what did that look like? What was the relationship like? What were the dynamics like? And how have you taken some of those lessons and carried them forward into your roles now?
Well, one of the first things was that he took a strong interest in who I was as a person and could see that I had a lot of potential, but it was going to take a lot of time. And so I had other people that were encouraging me to take shortcuts. And I don't mean that in the bad sense, but like, he understood that I had educational goals as well as athletic goals. And so he worked with me as a person so that I'd have the opportunity to go get the education I wanted, but I wasn't sacrificing my sports goals either. Mm-hmm. And over the years, our relationship changed from one of a coach to an athlete to a mentor and a protege to almost to teammates. By the time I was at the Olympics, I would have lunch with him every single week, and we'd go over the training that I was doing. We'd go over the upcoming training, we'd talk about it. It was much more of a partnership by that point. So the relationship definitely evolved over about a 12, 13 year period.
Hmm. You know, it's remarkable that when you the first person that you mentioned was your dad, and maybe it's not necessarily remarkable to you. It's something that's just a given for a lot of people, but whether it's a mentor or a parent's being some of our primary mentors initially, anyway, a lot of times the way that they teach us is through silent action, right? It's not necessarily that they're sitting you down and your dad is going to say, Eli, let me teach you the fundamentals of integrity and hard work. You know, it's just observation, right? So do you have a story or a moment that you can reflect back on where you're like, you saw your dad or your mom like working and making a decision that required them to tap into that integrity and work ethic?
Probably the most stark example I can give, when I was in high school, my dad ran for and was elected to the county commission. And that's a very technical position. You're working on development policy and things like that. It's not a heavily partisan type of deal, but it can be very controversial because you're dealing with where are we going to put in a new development, what restrictions are on it, things like that. I remember over the years, not once or twice, but many times, people would come up to me with the same story and they'd say, "Eli, I'm a big supporter of your dad because I opposed him on an issue or he took a different side, but we developed an incredible relationship and I understood why he had to take a different position." And so it gave me a tremendous understanding of the concept of you can disagree without being disagreeable. And the idea that my dad built an incredible relationship with many people and an incredible reputation for himself as being a fair and honest broker because he could disagree with people and they would still walk away and say, "That's someone who I respect."
You know, it reminds me of an old Voltaire quote that says, you know, something to the effect of, "I may disagree with you. I may not like what you have to say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it," you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that's lost in discourse today, whether it's, you know, an entrepreneurial thing or a political thing or, you know, just relationally, we just don't have the ability to disagree in an agreeable fashion.
Yeah, and I think that holds us back in many ways. We lose track of our humanity when that happens. We lose track of who we are. And oftentimes then the personalities can get in the way of finding a solution that is a win-win for many people. And entrepreneurship is not about beating other people. It's about finding solutions. So when you get out of the mindset of that we're people and we're put on this planet to work with other people and to help other people, it's hard to find solutions if you lose that perspective.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to your time in the Olympics. You know, first of all, like I didn't even really know what a pentathlete was or a pentathlon. I've heard of the decathlon, and so pentathlon is five events, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so can you tell us like what is a pentathlete? What sports are involved, and how did you come to decide that you were going to be a jack of all trades? It's kind of funny. As I was preparing for this conversation, I had this vision of like you and I at a barbecue and something like broke, right? And you're like, "Oh, I could fix that." And then like 10 minutes later, something else broke and you're like, "Oh, I could do that." You know, and I'm like, "Dang, this guy must be a pentathlete." And of course you are. So how did you discover the sport? How did you decide to pursue it? And what role did curiosity play?
Well, let's start with how the sport came to be, because then it makes a lot more sense.
Okay.
In the ancient Olympics, the Greek Olympics, the pentathlon was the sort of culminating event. It was the all-round athlete. So the Greeks valued the people that were well-rounded. And so they had the Greek pentathlon and it was war-fighting skills. So in 1896, when Pierre de Coubertin, who was a Frenchman, founded the modern Olympics, he wanted to come up with a new pentathlon. So the actual term now is the modern pentathlon, even though it's 130 years old. But he wanted that to be the test of the all-around athlete. And so there's five disciplines: shooting, fencing, swimming, horseback riding, and running. Each tests a different type of athleticism. So shooting tests your sort of emotional and mental maturity. It's a very unique type of athleticism. If you want to humble any other type of athlete, put a gun in their hand and put a target way down the range that you can barely see and say you have to hit the center of the target. It's like golf. So that's okay. Shooting. Fencing is a combat sport. And you've got to have some agility, but it's also about combat. Swimming is about strength and technique. Horseback riding is dealing with something that's really out of your control, because if you think you control a 1,200-pound animal, they'll quickly fix that for you. And then running is an endurance test. So that's how the pentathlon came to be. It was a test of all the types of athleticism that we see in the Olympics. I got involved because I started swimming and I rode horses growing up. And then I met Alan when I was in high school, and one thing led to another, and he started sort of mentoring me and coaching me. And I dreamed of going to the Olympics since I was a kid. That dream started when I was about 5 years old, and I met an Olympian on a flight, and I wish to this day I knew who that was. I have a couple ideas, but I don't know for sure who it was. But they planted that seed of going to the Olympics. And then when I heard about the pentathlon, I said, maybe this is the one for me. I tend to be very good at developing high-level proficiency in a lot of different things. So I like the diversity of that. And sure enough, I was able to go to college, did two sports in college, and then parlay my sort of talent for being able to pick up and replicate sports into a high-level success in the pentathlon.
Now, you went to the Air Force Academy. What sports did you play there?
I was on the swim team and the fencing team there. So, okay. Yeah. And those were both Division I programs, both high-level programs. And it was a great opportunity to really hone in my skills on those two disciplines.
Now, do you come from a background of athletes?
No, I don't. Okay. Not anything remarkable. So
when you think about the challenges for training for an event like the pentathlon versus something that's more focused like the 100 meter sprint or the 200 meter breaststroke or something along those lines, what are some of the challenges that you faced training for an event that where there's a multitude of different techniques and strategies and, you know, strengths and weaknesses? How did you approach all of that?
It's a giant balancing act, because if you start with the idea that you're going to train at 100%, And let's just get really mathematical about this. You can't go beyond 100%. Okay. So that's just all cliche. I trained at 120%. You're going to train as hard as you can. In a sport like swimming or running, it's really easy to see how you're going to do that because everything is geared toward one thing. I'm swimming. When you get to a pentathlon, the problem is the more I swim, the less I can run or fence or shoot or ride. And so you have to balance out your 100% effort and see how all these disciplines interact with each other. Some are more interactive than others. Obviously, swimming and running are very cardiovascularly taxing, whereas shooting is not. But if you're shooting, you're not resting and recovering from the run workout. So it took me years and years and years to sort of get into the rhythm of how I could balance my training. You also have to be agnostic as to where the results come from. That's one of the most difficult things that everybody faces in multi-sport, is we like to do what we like to do. And you can't just focus on what you like to do. You have to focus on, you know, what you're good at and where you're going to get the most points. So I enjoyed the challenge of that. I enjoyed having to work toward toward figuring out how to maximize my achievement over five disciplines. And it was a constant struggle. It was a constant struggle with coaches. That's another issue you face, is how do you go to a swimming specialist and educate them that I can't swim as much as you're used to, but I still need to garner the results. So it's just a challenge all the way around.
What's the most surprising thing you learned about yourself competing in these, you know, multitude of sports?
There's a couple ways I could answer that. The way I'm going to answer it is probably the most important lesson I learned from that was that the harder I trained, I didn't necessarily get better. The more I learned how to recover and to balance everything out, the more I advanced. And what was interesting was, as I learned to do that, I was able to balance and juggle more balls and get more things done. So I had to change my thinking away from, I'm just going to ram my way through this, because that's how I grew up. I was the hardest worker. I never missed a swim practice. I would swim 11 times a week in high school. And my parents said, if you don't want to wake us up for morning practice, that's fine. You're not in trouble. I never missed a practice. For about 12 years, not only did I not miss a practice on Christmas Day, I'd usually practice twice on Christmas Day. So hard work and just doing it all out was kind of how I viewed myself, and it was my self-image. And as I matured as an athlete and went from being a good athlete to one of the best in the world, I did that by sort of overriding that urge just to go really hard and to learn how to balance that recovery and let my body rebuild, let my brain rebuild. And that's very hard to do. It's kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah. You, in the last 2 minutes, you've kind of just touched on a couple of things that I think are really important lessons and opportunities for us to kind of, you know, pull on that thread a little bit deeper. The first was the idea of having the right kind of mindset going into these kinds of activities, whether it's, you know, competing in a pentathlon, anything where you have to basically become a versatile Swiss Army knife at any given moment. And you have to, you may like doing one thing, but you're scoring points doing another thing. And you have to go into that with this mindset where you're going to control, where you really have to take control of your brain, you know? So what kind of brain training did you do? What kind of stuff did you do to slow down your thinking, to take control of this organism that can really rapidly cause all of us to head down a really dangerous path?
Well, yeah, the brain is handily the most important, quote, muscle that any athlete has. And I started meeting very early on in my career with a sports psychologist. And I had that as a regular part of my training. And it's interesting, other athletes who didn't achieve the heights I did would make fun of it and say, oh, you're going to see the shrink. I didn't view it as a negative thing at all. We weren't talking about obscure things that you might think of in therapy. We were talking about stuff like, how are you going to handle the pressure? How do you handle the pressure of preparing your whole life for something and then having a problem? And that training of my brain paid off in spades. I think about the day that I qualified for the Olympics. It was at the Pan Am Games in 2007. I'd won Pan Am Championships the last 2 years. I was very dominant in the Western Hemisphere. And the winner of that competition was going to get to go to the Olympics. And I will tell you, there is no pressure like that of standing on the starting line and knowing that if you don't mess up, you will go to the Olympics. It's a lot less pressure to say, I have to have the day of my life. But to say, if I don't screw up, there's so much negative pressure on you. And I remember I had a shot. We would shoot 20 shots on slow fire. So on a 40-second interval, every 40 seconds, you have to shoot another shot. And I had a shot that I jerked the trigger and it was out of the black, which is a terrible shot. I mean, I dropped probably 5 points right there and just catastrophic. And I put my gun down and I sat down and I went through a couple mental tricks that we'd worked on with my psychologist. And we had actually planned for that. A lot of people were surprised that we planned for catastrophes. And so when the catastrophe struck, I reset myself. I had a game plan for it. 20 seconds later, I stood back up and was just smooth sailing from there forward, blew out the competition and punched my ticket to the Olympics.
What was the game plan?
The game plan was to, first of all, forgive yourself for screwing up. You know, it's really easy to just go into a free fall when you mess up and you know you messed up and to get down on yourself. And so the first piece was to accept and absorb. Just accept the reality. It hurt. It was embarrassing. There's all these TV cameras up there. There's these monitors everywhere. Everyone in the room could see what happened. Just accept it. The second one was to take control of what I could. And so I went to a much more prescribed list of actions. And I said, okay, I'm not going to trust myself to just do the right thing. I'm going to take proactive action and make myself do the right thing. And then get back to the process. And one of the things that kills us in sports is when you lose the process orientation. It's totally not sexy for all the movies out there that, you know, you think about Rudy and these other great sports movies, but focusing too much on the outcome is absolutely detrimental. So you have to get yourself back into that process orientation and say, I can't control where the bullet hits the target, but I can control that my sights are aligned. I pull the trigger correctly. I follow through afterwards and I care more about the process than I do the results. Mm-hmm. So I just sort of went down that checklist and that, you know, it worked out just fine.
You said something that was really powerful there, that you had to not just trust yourself that you were going to do the right thing. You had to make yourself do the right thing. So take us back to the next time sport that you were competing in, or the next time you were shooting. What was the difference there? What did you do differently?
Well, every time you're on the shooting range, it's a struggle because there's so much pressure. And one of the things that, again, as I matured as an athlete, that I did was I just had to learn to focus on the process. Because if you let yourself focus on the outcome, it's going to kill you. And I remember one day sitting with my sports psychologist and he said, Eli, the biggest problem you have right now is you have an overwhelming desire to win. And you need to change your focus to having an overwhelming desire to be good and to do the right thing. And it was counterintuitive at first, but then it became much more intuitive. And to the point where shooting was always a struggle for me. I liked the running and the swimming because, I mean, you could go out and you could hurt yourself and you could hurt your opponents. And I'm a type A personality. I like going out and getting it. So I actually, by the end of my career, I knew that shooting in the Olympics would be probably the highest pressure situation. And I made a commitment to myself that after the last shot of the Olympics, I would hold the gun up on a follow through for as long as my arm would take it. It's a completely illogical thing. The bullet's left the gun, it's hit the target, it's where it's going to be. But what it did was it put me in the right frame of mind to say that I will be illogically focused on the process. So much so that even after there's no way that it can have an impact on my process, I'll be true to myself and do the right thing. And as soon as I made that transition, my scores started getting better. I was more consistent. I made fewer errors for the rest of my career.
Wow, that's a powerful lesson. I mean, that takes follow through to a whole new level, you know?
Yeah.
Did you happen to watch the most recent Winter Olympics?
Extensively, yes.
Yeah, I figured being in Colorado Springs and being an Olympian, I figured you would have. But, there was this moment, and I've told this story, and I'm sure you probably saw it, but of this woman from the Czech Republic named Esther Zetka or something, where she was a two-sport athlete. She was competing in the Super G and also in a snowboarding competition. And, you know, Lindsey Vonn was a favorite. She washed out. Then the Austrian woman ended up seemingly taking the gold, right? And so she's down there at the bottom of the run. You know, Esther's up. She's the last to ski. She's in like 19th or 26th place in the event at this point. And, you know, everybody's hugging this Austrian woman. And the camera's panning back and forth between this Austrian woman getting her hugs and Esther up there on the mountain. And basically, everyone had written off Esther's likelihood that she could win. And so she starts her race. And by the time she comes down, and the cameras are panning back and forth, and all of a sudden, the commentators recognize that she's like 1/10 of a second ahead of the gold medal time. And so she gets down to the bottom of the run and sees her time, and literally her jaw is just dropped, and she asks the cameraman what happened.
Yeah, she thought there was a mistake. Yeah. She thought that the clock was wrong. I remember watching that.
Yeah, but she won. She won. And I think she probably, and I've actually tried to reach out to her a couple times to try to get her on the show, but definitely she went into a flow state. But the only reason that she was able to tap into a flow state was because she like just checked in on all of these processes. And it's when you don't follow that you get out of that.
That's right. And a couple of great lessons to be learned from that. One is, if you follow the process, it's always better than chasing the outcome. That's very important. And, you know, she just lost sight of where she was. And that happens actually not infrequently at the Olympics. That happens a number of times. And it's a lot easier to do that if you're way far behind, honestly. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. You know, I go back to my story of being at the Pan Am Games, and there's all this pressure because you're in the lead. And that's actually, you face different challenges if you're a follower or a leader. And in some ways, it's easier to be a follower. But long term, you've got to embrace being a leader if you're going to see the kind of results you want. There's another lesson, though, here that I think is very important. And I'm going to talk about another Olympic race, which involved Apollo Ohno. And sometimes it's easy to look at one outcome and say, okay, I don't want to read too much into that because she had a great race. But if she races that 10 more times, she never gets on the podium. And I learned this lesson early on. I was at the Olympic Training Center with Apollo before he became famous. I mean, he was just this guy kicking around at the training center with a crazy bandana. And the first race at the 2002 Olympics, Apollo was near the lead or in the lead. I mean, it's, you know, short track, and so it's very chaotic. And he wound up clipping a skate with a Korean skater, and the entire lead pack just got taken out, and Apollo and everybody else winds up in the side barriers. And there's an Australian athlete who was so bad, he was actually left from the pack. Okay, so the pack had pulled away from him. He's out of medal contention. He skates through and wins the gold medal. And Apollo skates through and wins the silver medal. And, you know, he scrambled up and wins the silver medal. And if you stop for that moment, I don't know just about anybody who would say, I would rather be Apollo than the Australian athlete. Everybody thinks, well, I want to be at the top of the podium. And so if you gave anyone in America, perhaps anyone in the world, the choice, would you rather be the Australian or the American at that moment, they would say the Australian. But Apollo would go on to become the most decorated Winter Olympian of all time. And the lesson there is, the Australian was lucky, Apollo was good.
Hmm.
And that was a lesson that took me a long time to learn, to quit trying to win and start trying to be good, because good athletes win more often. And so it's a very dangerous state of mind to be in, to focus on the outliers too much. Mm-hmm. So they're fun to look at. It's fun to look at what produced it and some of the conditions around it. But you look at guys like Peyton Manning, Drew Brees just passed Peyton Manning's passing yards. They are good, and that's why they produce results. And so whether it's in business or sports, I advise people, focus on being amazing. And it sounds light and fluffy, but
it's actually amazing. Really difficult.
Right. Like, and it's a much higher standard. It's a much higher standard. Winning can happen by accident, but being the best you can be or being the best in the world is much more hard, much more difficult than simply winning.
This episode is brought to you by the Lawton Marketing Group, a full-service advertising and design agency specializing in websites, social media, apps, logos, and more. Based in Oklahoma, they work with clients across the nation, from small businesses to large corporations and everything in between. You can find them right now on the web at www.lawtonmg.com or call them at 580-275-2063. Connect with them now for a complimentary competitive analysis of your website. Just tell them the Impact Entrepreneur told you to call.
You know, one of the things you mentioned earlier, and I think we can continue to talk about the dangers of focusing on winning, because you mentioned self-image. You mentioned that you were talking with your sports psychologist about self-image and about outcomes. And I think that way too often we attach our self-image, our self-worth with an outcome. So what are some of the major lessons that you've learned along the way that you carry forward today that prevent you from attaching the definition of your self-worth or your self-image with a potential outcome?
That's an ongoing struggle for everyone. You know, people ask you what you do and you say your job, or, you know, people ask about, as an athlete, you know, tell me how good you were, and yet you spew out results. So it's incredibly difficult. And I think, again, it can be a performance detriment. To me, it took a complete realigning toward integrity with myself to say, I have to be able to look in the mirror and know that I've done what I can do. Going back to my time in the Olympics, I qualified for the Olympics 13 months before the competition. And I had a lot of time to be able to really think through what I wanted my legacy at the Olympics to be. You know, you're going to go, you're going to compete. Something's going to happen there. You're going to win, you're not going to win. How do you want to look at that for the rest of your life? And I, again, through mentors, people like Dan O'Brien, who was a great mentor to me during that time, like my psychologists, like my coaches, we determined that my goal would be to be the fittest athlete in the world at the Olympics, because I could control that. I was in complete control that nobody else could have done the preparation that I would do. And that if I were the best prepared and the fittest athlete in the world, that I could live with that no matter what happened on a particular day. And unfortunately, that came to pass for me. In between walking in the opening ceremonies and competing, I had the worst accident of my life. I was involved with a crash on a horse. We were in Singapore for a training camp, and it was about 8 days before I was supposed to compete, and I wound up immobilized in the neck brace with a whiplash and a concussion. And I wasn't even cleared to compete in the Olympics until 3 days ahead of time. So I was just terrified that I wouldn't be able to start the competition, because then you're actually not an Olympian. If you don't compete in the Olympics, you lose that altogether. Mm-hmm. And I lost all the coordination in my hands, and had the worst competition of my year at that at the Olympics. And I was mortified. You know, I wish I could say I took it better than I did. I was so embarrassed. I didn't even want to see my family that day. But as I got away from that, I almost broke the world record 6 weeks later at the World Cup final, which was really the pinnacle of my sports career. But as I got farther and farther away, the more I was able to rely on the fact that I had integrity with myself and that I'd done everything I could to get ready for that competition. And as much as it hurt to have a freak accident take me out, at least I could say that's what took me out, as opposed to, you know, I didn't do as much as I could to win a medal. Mm. And so that I can live with, that I can look myself in the mirror every day the rest of my life and say, there was not one meal I could have eaten that was better. There was not one practice I could have done better in my preparation for the Olympics. So I can live with that. It still hurts, but I can live with it.
At what point did you decide that it was time to transition out of the world of professional sports?
Well, professional sports are, I think, as addictive as drugs. One of my best friends is a three-time German Olympian. He got fifth twice at the Olympics, and he spent a tremendous amount of time living in my house, training with me. We're very, very close personal friends to this day. But he said, Eli, it's doing sports to a sportsman is like doing a cocaine to an addict, because you're so stimulated and you so much want to do it. So I feel good about how I transitioned out. I took my time. A lot of athletes who kind of go out cold turkey wind up very depressed. You read about Michael Phelps. He's struggled with this. Ryan Lochte, now we're learning, has had similar demons he's faced. And that's a big issue. Steve Holcomb, gold medalist bobsledder, committed suicide a couple years ago. And mental health is becoming a more known problem with elite athletes. So I kind of took my time after the Olympics in 2008. I talked with my wife and I said, look, I want to start transitioning into something else. I felt like I could go back and potentially win a medal in the 2012 Olympics, but it became a lot less important to me than leveraging being an athlete and moving on to the next phase of life, because I knew, you know, I'd always be a husband. I'd always, you know, eventually be a dad, and that I needed to start reprioritizing. So that took place with me over about 4 or 5 years. And it was hard. It was hard changing my identity around from being, you know, a guy who'd run 60 miles a week and swim 25 miles a week. And, you know, that's who you are and you're representing your country, to I'm focusing on business endeavors. I'm focusing on other things. And I'm going to miss a practice to go to a business meeting, something mm-hmm. I didn't do for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. What was that first day like where you missed your first practice to begin pursuing something different?
I can honestly say I don't remember, because it just sort of started happening over time. Mm. And again, I feel like that was a huge boost to me, because I think if I'd gone cold turkey, I really would have struggled, like mm-hmm. just about every other athlete mm-hmm. I know.
Now, your wife is also an Olympian, right?
No. Actually, we met at the Olympic Training Center. She was an intern. Okay. We met first or second day that I was at the Olympic Training Center as an athlete, and she was out for a summer internship in college. So we dated for a year, got engaged for a year. She moved out and we got married. So
what was your pickup line?
Well, truth be told, I didn't know that athletes and interns weren't supposed to mingle, because I'd just gotten accepted there. And so I went into the atrium at the cafeteria, which again, the athletes don't usually sit there. I didn't know it. It was my first or second day. And this guy walks up to me and says, hey, I'm an intern. I don't know anybody. can we sit down and get to know each other? I said, sure. Super nice guy. His name's Nathan. And, you know, we're having a good conversation. And then about 5 or 10 minutes later, these three very attractive young ladies walk up and, you know, he says, oh, Eli, these guys are, or these gals are interns also. Do you mind if they join us? And I'm like, yeah, you know, no offense, but you know, I'm 23 years old and these are three very attractive college students. Absolutely. So it turned out one of them was a swimmer and asked me about, hey, you know, do you know any master swim teams that I can swim with? And I was swimming with the master's team at the time. I said, yeah, come on. You can swim with my team. And so we just started hanging out and that's how we met. So I wouldn't say there was a pickup line there. So I think no. I did. Now she knew what she was getting into. I proposed to her on a layover. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, it's kind of like everything you've done in your life. It happened incrementally. So it was just almost all of a sudden you woke up one morning and next thing you knew, you were standing at the altar.
That's right. Couldn't have planned it, but you know, I was ready for it. And I wasn't looking. And a lot of my life has been like that. You know, be ready, be prepared for when the opportunity comes, when that, you know. And so I honestly had no intention of even going on a date for the next 3 years because I just wanted to train and I didn't want to be distracted by any women. So, but that being said, I, you know, saw an amazing person and took the opportunity when it came.
Now, going back to your Olympic pursuits and your business pursuits, but specifically like right before you began to transition out of sports, did you have a sense of purpose and meaning beyond the actual act of competition? Or is that something that you had to develop as you decided that you were going to begin the transition out?
You know, I think that's something I'm very proud of that I did have early on. And some of that was probably ingrained in me by my parents. Some of it by my junior sports where you're representing your high school or you're representing your college. But there was a pivotal time in my life going back to September 11th, 2001, I was at the Olympic Training Center when the towers were hit and I had to go out to Schriever Air Force Base to work and they were in ThreatCon Delta. Everything was locked down. And obviously that has a profound impact on your life, to go through that event, especially to be in the military and to see, you know the classmates of mine who were in combat roles would be going into battle. But it was about a year and a half later that I got a call from my dad. He said, turn on the TV. Your uncle's about to make national news. And my uncle was standing next to the president of the United States, who was announcing that he would be taking over reconstruction of the country of Iraq. And, yeah, that's Ambassador Paul Bremer. Yeah. And so he was standing there with the president. He had been rumored to maybe be up for Secretary of State, but the president had tapped him for this. And the backstory of that, my uncle was sitting on a jet getting ready to go to New York because he had an office there. And he lost, I think, about 130 people in the attack. The plane hit his the floor where his employees were. So he was the CEO of a company. And plane went right in there and killed a whole bunch of people he knew. So he said, I'll do anything I can to help the nation recover, help the effort. But I was 2003 was the first year I made the finals of the World Championships, which is harder than qualifying for the Olympics. That's you're really at the Olympic level when you do that. And my uncle was, you know, a common name throughout the world. So it was, you know, all of a sudden I became defined by that, and it helped give me a perspective that I was doing something bigger, that I was representing our nation and that our nation needed to have something that was like sports that was uncontroversial that we could all rally around. So that shaped me a lot. And I sort of held on to that. In fact, I've got in my office here at my house, I've got a huge printout of a spread by the Denver Post. And the headline says Bremer's Patriot Act. And it's got a picture of me in my uniform at the Pan American Games winning that competition and talking about the significance of being a military officer competing in the Olympics. So, you know, I think I had a big perspective on that. And then, you know, in the devastation that was the day of the Olympics for me, I sat down in the rain for about 20 minutes. I wasn't even sure that I would go up and see my family. I was so utterly humiliated to finish 22nd place when I'd been, you know, expecting to be competing for a medal. And when I finally got up there, I got mobbed by the Chinese. It was in Beijing. So got mobbed by all these Chinese citizens who were there, you know, who'd bought this ticket and they probably saved up to buy this ticket. And I spent 20 or 30 minutes signing autographs and doing photos. And I found out afterwards that one of my coaches turned to my family and said, you know, none of these people are going to remember who won the medals today, but they're for the rest of their life, they're going to remember that Eli took the time to talk with them. And it took me a while to appreciate that, you know, that was the impact I had that day. So, you know, I've kind of carried that with me, that you've got to be doing it for something bigger than yourself, because you just don't know in life when you have that accident like I had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's business, you're chugging along, everything's going great, and you get broadsided. And if you're just in it for the results, you have no perspective, and you're not going to be able to recover from those catastrophes.
Mm-hmm. Dude, that's a nugget of wisdom right there, and something I can completely relate to. It comes down to humanity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to acknowledging what you did that day was you acknowledged the humanity. You saw someone else. You helped someone else become seen in the presence of greatness. I mean, you had sacrificed so much to pursue this endeavor to compete for a medal. And even though you didn't achieve that, you still, you know, represent greatness, which people aspire to. And, you know, and so you took time to see the greatness in other people by acknowledging them and their desire to interact with you and to be at the games and to be inspired by all of that. And you carry that forward today as an entrepreneur, and you left the games, you left the professional competition world of sports anyway, and you entered the very equally competitive world of
more entrepreneurship.
Yes, the more competitive, more cutthroat, definitely heavily focused on more outcome than process and speed, and not necessarily doing it while maintaining integrity. So number one, you probably could have gone anywhere. You probably could have gone and done some corporate gig. You probably could have gone back into the military and served out, you know, as a active duty officer for the rest of your career. Why did you? You're part of the reserves now, I understand, but
just left the reserves actually.
Oh, but you trying did. To get okay.
back, you know, hopefully.
Okay. So why entrepreneurship? What drew you to that as opposed to something else?
When I was getting my MBA before the Olympics, and one of the last courses I took was entrepreneurship. And I walked in, and Professor Al Wiles was there, and he said, this should be the capstone course instead of the capstone course. And I thought, what an arrogant thing to say. And we got into it, and we spent the semester studying entrepreneurship. And on my end of course critique, I wrote, this should be the capstone course. Because it was the epitome of everything in business. And I said, entrepreneurship's where it's at. It's how jobs are created. It's how people get out of poverty. It's everything that's right in the modern world is creating a new good or a service that doesn't exist. And what people don't understand about entrepreneurship is it's only successful if you're providing a good or a service for somebody else that's more important to them than their money is. And so at the end, entrepreneurship is about helping other people. And I loved that. And I fell in love with it. And I said, I want to start stuff. That's partly why I got out of the military. The active part of the military is the military is highly bureaucratic. And they're really working on trying to change that. But I was uncomfortable being in that environment from there forward, not because it's wrong, but because I said, I want to start stuff, and I want to have a huge impact on other people's lives. So I fell in love with entrepreneurship, and I was looking for opportunities, and they've started coming to me through various different forms. And it's interesting, some of the most successful things I've been able to do have been much less focused on making money and much more importance and focus on having an impact that matters to other people. And they become financially successful. That's the great thing about it, is that then that becomes very successful.
Mm-hmm.
The most important thing I learned in my entire business career was I was in college at the academy. My mom was doing executive recruiting, and she had a guy interviewing for CEO or COO at some major corporation. And he said, Eli, do you want to know how to make $250,000 a year? And I'm thinking, if a four-star general doesn't make anything like that, so in 40 years, if I'm on my track, I'm not going to make that. And he said, it's super easy. If you tell me how you're going to make me $500,000 a year, I'll give you $250,000 to do it. And if you want to make $1 million a year, just tell me how you make me 1.25 to 1.5 and you've got a job in a million. And that changed the way I thought about, you know, compensation. So yeah, after the Olympics, I worked with an executive recruiter. I had some very, very tempting jobs, paid a lot of money, but it would require going into a big business and sitting in a big corporation and having an office and a cubicle. And I just didn't want to do that. I wanted to go out and create value for other people and in the process, create value for myself. So that altered the trajectory of my life.
So what was the process, going back to the process, that you used to eliminate things, eliminate choices?
Well,
even good ones.
I wouldn't say I had a strict method for exactly how to do that. My wife was very supportive on this. And so what we did was we looked for opportunities that made sense and that fit. And arguably my biggest success has been starting this Olympic sponsorship program, which was very missional when I started it. And it actually started out of a failure. And that's another thing that I think people are scared of failures. I had to learn that in sports too. I started a business coming out of the Olympics where we were going to take athletes and take the lessons of sports psychology and apply it into business. Fantastic business model. The problem was we started it during a recession and corporate training budgets were just getting slashed. And, you know, that was sort of what doomed that business. But in the process, I learned a tremendous amount about how to work with athletes and how to work with business people. I wound up parlaying that into a very successful business that did business travel for people staying at luxury hotels in Colorado Springs, interacting with Olympians. And then from there, I wound up working with a company that wanted to have a sports sponsorship program, you know, and we created now what I believe is the largest Olympic sponsorship program that's ever been built. We got 92.
Pure Performance with Shaqley?
Yeah, Shaqley Pure Performance, yeah. And so it just kind of evolved into this sort of mega operation. And we work with a tremendous number of athletes and it's growing and it's really a marquee program now. So that's an interesting example of an entrepreneurial activity that sort of grew out of almost nothing and out of a couple failures along the way, but has turned into an incredibly successful operation. I had a call a couple weeks ago with a Fortune 50 company that said, we love what you're doing for Shaqley, and we're very interested in parlaying that over to our marketing program. It's gotten a lot of notoriety.
How have you gone about seeing and developing talent in others in this new venture?
Boy, that's been one of the toughest issues. You know, I have a passion for supporting Olympians, partly because they spend so much of their life doing sports, and then they have a hard time getting out of them and moving on into business. So that's been a theme of mine for about 10 years. Identifying top tier talent who are Olympians who can also support my vision there is difficult. I'm mentoring a young man right now who is getting his MBA at Duke. He's a Mexican national, and we brought him into my program, and he had a surprise bronze medal. He's from my sport, and you know, I realized very early on this gentleman had tremendous amounts of talent outside of sports, and so I've been mentoring him, working on getting him into a job right now that's going to really leverage his skill sets, and I think he'll be coming on board with me to support a lot of my efforts. So. I also do a lot with athletes in coaching their speaking and in coaching them and mentoring them on how to leverage what they took out of the Olympics into corporate America, because it's so difficult. Last week, I had a tremendous call with a two-time Olympian who's just getting started on her own. And we talked about, you know, how do you personally brand yourself? How is this providing value for companies? So I get a tremendous amount of intrinsic pleasure out of being able to help these world-class athletes try to parlay their success into business.
Have you heard of the organization Rise Athletes?
I don't believe so.
It was started by Rebecca Soni and Caroline Burkle, two Olympic swimmers. Mm-hmm. It's a youth mentoring program of aspiring Olympic athletes. It's a phenomenal program. Led by two phenomenal women that I'd be happy to connect you with if you're interested. You know, this has been incredibly insightful. I mean, so much wisdom, man. I mean, like the lessons the focusing on the process and not necessarily the outcome, and using that, make that decision to protect yourself from your self-worth and image being tied to a particular outcome. And I know that this is going to serve a tremendous amount of people, this conversation that we've had, and we could probably continue going for like another 2 hours or more. And maybe we'll come back and do another part, but I want to make sure that people know how to connect with you and learn more about you online. So where would you send them to do that?
You can go to my website, which is elibremmer.com. Go to Facebook. I'm all over Facebook. You're going to see a lot of my Shackley stuff there. I do probably about 100, 150 appearances a year for them. So reach out to me on Facebook. If you want a personal connection, shoot me a Facebook Messenger, because I don't just take, if we don't have a lot of friends in common, I don't accept those, obviously, because of all the bots out there. You can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm very stingy on who I accept on LinkedIn, but if you've got a business question, then absolutely shoot it to me and we can connect on LinkedIn as well.
Okay, awesome. So we'll link to those things in the show notes as well. And I conclude every conversation with three questions that I ask every single guest. So the first question is, if you could pick any skill set that you currently possess, okay? So a skill you currently have, which as we've talked about is many, and turn it into a superpower, what would it be?
Golf. Ever since retiring from sports, I had to pick something completely different. And golf is now the bane of my existence. Mm. But partly that's because it's also a great opportunity to form connections with other people. Mm-hmm. And I formed some amazing bonds with people on the golf course. Mm. And I grew up wanting to be a ski bum. And now I'm like, no, I want to be a golfer. I look at these golfers on TV and I'm like, man, I wish I could do that. So that might seem a little shallow, but it actually fits into the relational person that I am. And I just love going out with people and learning who they are and spending 4 hours with them. And quite frankly, you learn what happens when catastrophe strikes, because you're not going to play 18 holes without a catastrophe.
So yeah, you learn. Tiger Woods comeback, by the way. I mean,
talk pretty amazing
process, so, and sticking with the process.
Yeah, so I have a fantasy of being an elite golfer someday. I'm a 22 handicap, so I don't think the PGA needs to worry about that.
What are three lies that prevent us, that keep us from developing and maintaining our competitive edge?
I think that the first one is that the results are indicative of how good you actually are. And that's a dicey one. We talked about that earlier. Don't just look at the results, look at the process. And so we get caught up so much on focusing on the results. Mm. I think another one is that successful people don't have struggles, or that they don't have failures. Every elite athlete I know, and I don't know how many gold medalists I know, 50, 60, 70, I don't know. It's lots. I work with tons of people at that level. And every single one, bar none, could go on for hours on end about all the failures they've had. And if you ask them to talk about their successes, they're done in 2 minutes. So I think it's so many people, I think when they see, you know, what I've done, I look at my life as a serial failure and just happen to have a few successes along the way. Most people look at it and say, you're serially successful. And I'm like, no, you don't know the backstory. Mm-hmm. So I think those are two of the biggest ones. I got to think if I've got a third lie that we tell ourselves. How about that it's ever going to be easy? I have never found anything to be easy, and successful people I know, you know, they give up on that. So I think the idea that life is easy is a myth. Now you can mitigate that. I would train hard and I'd recover hard. I put in a hot tub at my house, because it was so important to recover. But that's a myth that I have to keep on telling myself. I don't expect life's ever going to be easy, but it can be incredibly rewarding.
This last question, it comes from the title of a book written by a guy named Clay Christensen. It's the book is called How Will You Measure Your Life? And you've done a lot of thinking about that question over the course of your athletic career. And now as an entrepreneur, there's no doubt that you've thought about that question. But I ask it in a different way now. And this is why I asked you before we hit record, what your favorite form of art is. And you said dance, right? So... this might surprise some people, you know, that you took some competitive, you took dancing seriously for how long?
It was four months. I was part of a charity dance competition, and Boy, talk about a humbling experience.
So if you could, you know, using the idea of dance, and if it's 100 years from now, and you left a set of instructions for a choreographer to design and curate a dance routine that would answer the question, how Eli Bremmer would measure his life, what would those instructions include?
I want them to know that nothing ever came easy, but I would never give up. And that when setbacks came, I tried to use them as opportunities. And I was willing to both work harder, but also be cognizant of being smart about that. And I'd also want in there that in everything I did, I wanted to impact other people in a positive way. You know, any organization I'm with, I want to have, when I leave them, because as an entrepreneur, you can't sit still for very long, that they're in a much better place and that people will say, okay, I'm really glad that Eli was involved with us for that 6 months or 2 years or 5 years or whatever it is. Mm. And then that bleeds over to people's lives too. I mean, I want to tell the story of, you know, people that I've, you know, now I'm in the position of mentoring a number of people that they say, you know, Eli left his mark on our lives too. Excluded from that is he owned a yacht, you know, or anything like that. I have very little care for the monetary trappings that come with being a successful entrepreneur. It would be much more about, you know, the impact on people. You know, he helped, you know, 250 Olympians financially support themselves, things like that. That's what matters the most.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eli, I am certainly grateful for the last hour or so that we've been able to spend together and look forward to continuing to collaborate in the future. And thank you so much for taking time and joining our audience today.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you to this week's guest, and thank you for listening. If you missed any of the key points and highlights from my conversation, we've got you covered over at theimpactentrepreneur.net/podcast for show notes to each and every episode. And while you are there, check out Flynn Wealth Strategies and Insurance Solutions. You can do that by visiting flynnwealthstrategies.com. The Lawton Marketing Group and the Podcast Masters. We could not do this show without them and with all of their support. Now, until next time, go make an impact.